This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
You know, when I've had conversations about the commune, because when I go out to dinner with friends, we all just talk about the commune. What we realize is the commune is just a blank slate that everybody on the left projects whatever image they would like on it. So what I'd like to talk about first is what the commune was not. So the first thing is that even though we think of it as being part of like the international communist movement, in fact, it was one thing it was not a Marxist movement. There were members of the First International who were involved, but mostly they were followers of Proudhon. Marx wrote his great book, The Civil War in France, but as I said, those who were followers of the International were not Marxists. And in fact, later on in the life of the Commune, they weren't even the hardest line members. They were a bit of the minority, and they were actually the most liberal wing of the Commune. Something else that absolutely and definitely most in no way was anarchist. Nobody should ever make that mistake. It was a government, it had departments, it had elections, people, it had an important effect on the anarchist movement, which I'll talk about later. And Louise Michel, who's she up there now, was a rank and file member of the commune, but this was not in any way an anarchist movement. What it was a spontaneous outburst of all the repressed feelings of the French working class over the course of the last 20 years of the dictatorship of Napoleon III. And it was also an outbreak due to the onerous surrender conditions and its insult to working class pride, which I'll talk about in a minute. As Marx said, it was the first revolution in which the working class was openly acknowledged as the only class capable of social initiative. Now there was, of course, a tutelary figure. And if there was one, it was August Blanqui, the great conspirator who spent most of his life in jail. And in fact, before the outbreak of the commune, during the period between the French surrender and the commune, his followers had actually led two uprisings in the period before the commune. And as a result of that, Blanqui was in prison and was held as a chip by the bargaining chip by the government in Versailles. So, after the insult of the indemnities, there was heavy indemnities that the French had to pay. The Prussians demanded the right to march through Paris. On March 18th, two generals went up to... There we go. Two generals went up to Montmartre, the working class neighborhood, to take back the cannons that the workers had paid for. The workers rose up against them, and they killed the two generals. The revolution had begun. This was March 18, 1871. A provisional government was established. It was run by the National Guard, and a week later, on March 26th, were the actual elections for the commune. So, and running for the commune was all, the elections were held all over Paris. Every political idea was represented. And in fact, though, after the elections were held, those from the bourgeois neighborhoods didn't serve in the commune. So in the end, there were 70 sitting members of the commune, and 25 of them were actual members of the working class. But in essence, what this meant was Paris had seceded from the rest of France. The rest of France had the Republican government, which was now sitting in Versailles. Paris had its own government, and it was hoping that communes would break out everywhere. And in fact, there were communes in Marseille, Lyon, and other major cities. It didn't last quite as long. So, as soon as the commune was elected, it set to work completely overturning the social structure in France, or at least in Paris. So, the first thing it did was it abolished the standing army. It abolished the standing army. And the National Guard then became the official army of France. They burned the guillotine. On April 3rd, they passed an act declaring the separation of church and state and cutting off all government support to the churches, any religion. And a very important one in a country like France, they banned night work for bakers. Okay, which people, often in books, they make a joke about it, but the bakers worked through the night. You know the French have to have their bread, so it was a really important measure. They also freed, it was held in the pawn shops, were all released, and also rents were refunded and payments of any debts due were put off
Also, the women, they also recognized civil union. So any couple that wasn't married but was living together as man and wife, if either one of the partners was killed, if the man was in the National Guard, was killed fighting, well then, even though they weren't married, the widow had the right to a pension. A really important and controversial one was they passed a decree on hostages. And the decree said, if our enemies massacre yet one more of our soldiers, we will answer with the execution of either the same or twice the number of prisoners. Now, already, as soon as the fighting had begun, the Versailles forces were killing any captured communards, any members of the National Guard. So the commune offered to trade all the hostages that they had taken just to exchange for Blanqui. But the Versailles forces were too nervous. What would happen if Blanqui was released? They never released him, and so the hostages were held, and you'll see that it has disastrous consequences. The commune was intensely aware of symbolism, and symbolism plays a really important part in this whole story, both during and after. So very early on, they destroyed the Chapelle Expiatoire, which, anybody who's been to Paris, it was a chapel that was built in expiation, begging for forgiveness for the execution of Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette. The commune didn't have anything to do with it. They destroyed the chapel. But then they also decreed the destruction of the Vendôme Column, which was put up by Napoleon I, and which was made out of captured cannons during Napoleon's campaigns. So for them, the Vendôme Column was a symbol of militarism, dictatorship, and they wanted nothing to do with it, so they decreed the destruction of the column, and the great Gustave Courbet was put in charge of the project of tearing the column down. And it was finally torn down on May 16th, when the commune had barely 2 weeks left to live, and Courbet paid for it dearly. At the end of the war, when the commune was crushed, Courbet was put in jail, and he was fined 323,000 francs. He had to sell almost all of his artworks in order to pay for it. It was also, though, a military campaign, which would never be forgotten because it was a war. And almost immediately, the Versailles forces attacked the commune, and on April 3rd, the commune, it was a big debate, it actually is in the film, in the play, if any of you watch it, was should the communards stay within Paris or should they go out and attack? The commune went out and attacked. It was a complete disaster. And of course, in true left-wing fashion, the immediate assumption was people were traitors, we had the wrong generals, the generals were all in the pay of the bourgeoisie. It became extremely ugly, and it raised the question of, within the commune, do you want to have generals or revolutionaries to lead the professional generals or revolutionaries? It's the kind of debate that happened in China during the Cultural Revolution, red or expert. So already oral debates that would take place 100 years later began back then. Little by little, the forces from Versailles captured every fort around Paris, and by May 21st, they entered Paris. There's some debate about how it happened. Did somebody open the gates for them? Was there betrayal there? But they came in, and this was the beginning of La Semaine Sanglante, the Bloody Week. Street by street, barricade by barricade, the Versailles forces came in, the Parisians fought, and finally, in desperation, the hostages that the commune held and that Versailles was not willing to exchange Blanqui for were all killed. 47 hostages were killed, including the Archbishop of Paris, d'Arbois. And this will be important, you'll hear why in a couple of minutes, but this has always been held up as a sign of just how bloodthirsty and murderous the commune was. You know, the thousands that were killed before they did this, before the commune finally acted on a decree that had been issued that everybody knew about, was usually completely ignored. And on May 28th, the last stand of the commune took place at Père Lachaise Cemetery, okay? So the question is, and the debate went on for decades afterwards, why did the commune fail? So there are those who, in 1897 actually, the great literary journal, La Revue Blanche, had a two-part series where they interviewed every former communard they could find. Why did the commune fail? What is your opinion now of the Paris Commune? And many of the members, the people said, they should have seized the money that was held in the Bank of France. There was money in the Bank of France, the commune never touched it. Then there was also, should it have been, you know, more aggressive, and should it have been more repressive? Because until the very end, all newspapers were legal under the commune. And it was a lesson that was to be learned in many wrong ways by the left afterwards. But the commune, and again, it was the internationalists, the followers of the First International, who were most vocal in defending the right of freedom of the press. So it's actually an interesting thing there. The question also was, should they have concentrated on anything but victory? Should they have been passing all these measures about night work and about women's rights and everything, or should everything have been just victory? And this debate would happen again 60-some years later in Spain, where should the Spanish Republicans have concentrated on defeating Franco, or should they have also carried out the measures they tried to do? It also had a very important impact on the anarchist movement, and in a very strange way, that everybody knows, we always hear about bomb throwers, you know, the anarchist bomb throwers in the 1890s. Well, the greatest of them all, if we can call him that, Émile Henry, was the son of a communard. And many anarchists, a very strong wing of the anarchist movement in France in the late 19th, early 20th century, learned the lesson from the commune that there's no point in revolution, that the workers rising up will result in nothing but being crushed. And the great Victor Serge called it the revolutionary illusion. And so this is where you get individual anarchists, individualist anarchists throwing bombs in cafes, because when you can't rise up, we'll never defeat an army. We have to do it whichever way we can. Kind of like, you know, Palestinians in the 70s and 80s. Now, symbolism. People have been to Paris. People schlep up to Montmartre, and they buy tchotchkes here at Sacré-Cœur. Sacré-Cœur was built right after the commune, and it's where it is for a political reason. It's built right up where the heart of the commune was, where the revolutionary workers were, and it symbolizes, because it crushes Paris from up on top of the mountain, and that's just what it's intended to do. It demonstrates the reestablishment of moral order and the power of the church. So nobody should go up there. Okay? Okay? Right, with your red sashes. Now, of course, there is other symbolism. And this one, and here we have the Mur des Fédérés. The Mur des Fédérés, the War of the Federals, was where the last stand on May 28th was of the communards. The last communards were killed there. This became a place of pilgrimage. There's a sign on the wall here that says, Au mort de la commune, to the dead of the commune. All the great heroes of the French working class are buried in this area. As is, interestingly enough, Edith Piaf is buried about 20 feet from this wall. But this became a place of pilgrimage for leftists, and continues to be one. If you go to Paris now, even what little is left of the working class movement, on May Day, there are still bouquets placed at the Mur des Fédérés. You know, the final words on the commune, though, Zoe mentioned that the Internationale, the words were written by Eugène Potier, who was a communard, and he wrote a beautiful poem. And in the chorus of the poem, it goes, La commune n'est pas morte. The commune isn't dead. Thank you.
So this is Zoe Bella, who is the artist. So as you can tell, she's an artist in a wide array of media, including film, projection, performance, installation, and drawing. And she's also a professor of media studies and art at Queen's College, CUNY. And Zoe generally considers herself a medium, an interface between the real and the imaginary, connecting the present to the past to illuminate the future in new ways. So with that in mind, I was wondering what it was about this pieces in conversation with the days of the commune and in solidarity with Occupy Wall Street. So I wondered if perhaps you could start by talking about what it was about the days of the commune that you thought spoke to Occupy Wall Street, how you first encountered the play and the movement, and how you thought they spoke to each other.
I had been thinking about kind of utopian movements. It was something I was interested in my work, and I was, you know, thinking about it theoretically in my apartment in the fall of 2011, and suddenly went, oh my God, there is one right now about half a mile from my house. So I just kind of went down to Zuccotti Park, where the occupying encampment was, and I really was just curious. I wanted to know what was going on, and perchance it happened that I had just started teaching this intro to drawing class, drawing one, in which I suggested to my students that, in fact, required my students to draw their daily life. And I got so sick of little tchotchkes on the mantelpiece and teddy bears, I was like, let's get life in here. That, you know, sometimes as teachers, you just have to do things yourself, right? So I would go down, I started going down to Occupy, and just as a practice, with nothing else in mind, I started to draw. And drawing was an interesting way to listen and think and spend time. And just as I would do this, I started, and it's not something I'd really ever done before, which is like just drawing in the world. I mean, I grew up to think that drawing was like, it was like sketching was a pastime of Victorian girls, you know. I was too modern for that. I started to think back to, as I was drawing the encampment, to the drawings that were done in the 19th century, to the drawing, the great drawings of modern life, when documentary drawing was really important, like Courbet, like Manet, people who actually drew during the Paris Commune. And that really started me thinking about the relationship between the two movements and the idea of the Commune as kind of the first great occupation of modern history. They didn't just take over city block, they took over their whole city and decided that they, to lead by example, that was what was so beautiful. Rather than simply protest, they would have a new form of government, they would lead France by example, and they truly believed that the people would join them. So just the way the occupation, the encampment, was a way of leading by example to try and form a more democratic city. It was never meant to be a real city, but the idea that there would be free food, there would be medical attention, that there would be free education, all those kind of things that the Commune believed in. So I became really interested, and then I was reading this biography of Brecht, and I suddenly stumbled upon the fact he wrote a play called Days of the Commune. I was like, oh my God, we have to do this, like right now. And it kind of gave me a form. And one thing I learned that I consider incredibly important from the Occupy movement was you just have to do something right now, like whether you know how to do it or not. You know, time is now. So I have never, I'm not a theater director, I've never directed theater. I didn't have budget, I didn't have funding, I didn't have actors, but I thought we have to do this. So that's how we started.
Great. So can you talk a little bit about the, going off of this, the improvisational nature of the piece, talking about sort of the relationship between rehearsal and performance and the relationship between the site-specific performance and then the film and then the exhibit as it travels?
Okay. Well, As I say, I didn't have a theater, I didn't have funding, but I realized I didn't want a theater. Theater wasn't the point, the street was a theater. I mean, to me, the Occupy encampment was a form of theater. I mean, in a serious way, the General Assembly meetings were also to learn about democracy. It wasn't just what they were doing, but to suggest, you know, a way that people can work together. So it was already theater. So I wanted to, so the street became enormously important. I even if somebody had offered me a theater, I wouldn't have taken it. So, and I wanted it to be a commune of all New York. Although I was interested in the actual history of the Paris Commune, and that's how I found Mitch, was I read his book. I was really interested in making a work about New York today, of which that I felt we could learn from the Commune, but it was about this New York. And I wanted the Communards to be all New Yorkers. So I didn't want to make it just like professional actors. I wanted all kinds of different people, all ages, all backgrounds, whatever. So, and I wanted people who would be interested, not just like because they were out of work actors or something, but interested in doing this task. And I saw it as a task. So I put out a call on the Occupy performance listserv and posted up in some downtown theaters and called up some friends, and assembled a little group of communards. Now, the play, Brecht's play, is rarely done, and I kind of know why. It's because it's huge. It's got 50 speaking parts, and it's like 2.5 hours long. And I realized immediately I wasn't so interested in like getting 50 actors. It seemed insane. But how many speaking parts in any one scene? And that was only 18. So that was kind of my goal. And I think we had about 13 or 14 people initially. I said, I don't care if you have experience or not. I just want people who are ready to perform in a public space with a loud voice. I think in the end, maybe half the people were professional actors, or many of them a year. Other people do all kinds of things. And that's partly what the commune was. They weren't professional politicians. Mm-hmm. They were people from all kinds of backgrounds who kind of learned on the job. And I felt the idea was that we would all learn together on the job. I didn't have money for rehearsal space or anything like that. Is that we would rehearse in public. And I meant that conceptually also, the way we would rehearse for a new kind of city in public, because it's work. And to make a new kind of city, you have to work together. So I wanted to show the work. So it was never about making some kind of like slick, well-rehearsed, you know, entertainment. I wanted us to show what we did and how we did it and how to work together. And it was a little chaotic. You know, we worked on Saturdays and Sundays. We went out, I think, for 3 hours on Saturday and 3 hours on Sunday. That was about the longest you could work in the freezing cold without a bathroom break. I had no permits. I didn't have money for permits. And I also believed that, you know, public space should be free and open to all. I really believe that you should not need permits. We started in the first month in Zuccotti Park, where the Occupy encampment no longer was, but people were still coming down there, and then moved to other public spaces in New York. And you know, talking to people afterwards, many of the performers, I mean, some of them were saying, oh, it was like so well organized. But like, if you talk to Neera and I on Friday afternoon, Neera is here, she was working with me on the organization, it was always chaotic. Like, somebody always got sick, somebody always got a call for a part they were not expecting. So not only did everybody play multiple characters, but also some characters were played by multiple actors. So, you know, on Saturday, Papa was Michael Paul Brito. On Sunday, he was Pedro Gonzalez. And they were two different Papas. But I think that's really interesting, actually. So it was a whole different way of thinking about acting, performance, and what a character is, even. So a character was kind of a mutable thing. And gradually it grew. I think in our last scene, there's like 22 people. So I'm really proud of it. I mean, I had no idea when I started. I thought maybe people flake out. I had no idea what was going to happen. But, you know, like Deborah was in the audience, and then I was like, Deborah, come on in, join us. We need some tough French working class women.
So can you talk about the props and your use of how you designed all of the materials that went along with the performance?
The props. I mean, the props were basically, it was partly just practical. Because we didn't have permits, we couldn't put anything down. So everything had to be carried with us. So everything had to be light and portable. Like all those signs with the dates, all those signs, they were on poles, you know, so people held, you can see it in the play, people held them up. And I'll come to why the dates in a minute, but everything had to be light, portable, easily transportable. Also, I was obviously inspired by, you know, protest movement. It's like if you were down in Zuccotti Park when the occupation was going on, people had cardboard signs around their necks talking about whatever they wanted to talk about. There was cardboard signs everywhere. In my little essay that goes in the publication, we call it cardboard is the language of protest. And it really is. It's the cheapest possible material. It's sturdy. It's light. And So that's kind of what got me rolling, and then I sort of couldn't stop. So there were certain things, like in part because each character was often played by different people, it was really important that people wore the name of their character. But as I say, it was also a nod to the Occupy movement. I mean, I, as an artist, I'm also really inspired by the work of Thomas Hirschhorn. Some of you might know his work. He's a Swiss artist who uses cardboard and packing tape and really cheap materials. He does like amazing and I think very strong political work. So I'm really into the vernacular material. I really fell in love with cardboard. Expect more cardboard from me.
And what about the temporality of the performance, the way in which it took place one scene per day on the weekends and unfolded across the spring? And the actors, professional or non, had to sort of fit it into their working week, right?
Yeah, I mean, that was partly, again, just necessity. It's like all of us, myself included, we all have day jobs. I mean, none of us can have the luxury, artists no longer have the luxury of just doing their art or their theater or whatever. So we all have day jobs. And it seemed like the weekends would be when people could work. And I could only pay people really, really little. I mean, I kind of admire, I don't know how many of you know Peter Watkins, Commune. Peter Watkins is a filmmaker, and he did this 8-hour-long piece about the Paris Commune called La Commune. And he also worked with non-professional actors, but he was funded, he did this in 2000, he was funded by French television, so he could afford to bring people together for 3 months to do nothing else. We all had to do our jobs. So my idea was that we would do it scene at a time, and each day we went out, we would work on the scene. So we would do it over and over again, which was, in some ways, it made it very disjointed. In other ways, given the kind of chaos of New York, people don't have time to sit on the street and watch a 2.5-hour play. You know, they could watch one short scene. You know, a scene might take 10 minutes. We did it 4 or 5 times during our work period. So it kind of worked for that. Every week we would put the scenes online. So if you couldn't be there or were in another part of the world, you could see the work online. And I think one of the ways that we most publicized the event, which was actually a very kind of 19th century way, was we handed out these broadsheets on the street and they kind of told you what we were doing and where you could find us and what we were doing online. So you can, by the way, you're welcome to take these. We always give them out. So yeah, I had the idea in November, but then just kind of getting it all organized, I realized it would be really great if we did it from, we started at the beginning of March and we went through the end of May, which was the 3 months that the Paris Commune actually existed. So when you see the film, you kind of see the time. You see people freezing at the beginning of March, and then it's summer by the end. So you really get a sense of the time span and the idea of a work over time, which is not what you would do if you saw a play in the theater.
And you also see the changing status of the Occupy Wall Street movement, right, in the background. So can you talk more about the locations?
Well, like I said, we started for the first month in Zuccotti Park, and we entertained the police weekly. They always enjoyed our songs. They read our broadsheet carefully. Then I wanted to go kind of really, I mean, the Paris Commune was a commune of all Paris, and I thought we should go to other places in New York. And kind of, I wanted to find locations that were open to the public, where people were somewhat comfortable watching, and that resonated with the story. And Joni, who is sitting over here, had the wonderful idea of working in the community garden. So she hooked me up with community garden people, and we did a lot of stuff of scenes of the French working people, the ordinary people of Paris, that took place. You'll see it in this beautiful garden. It's on East 6th Street and Avenue B in New York. And that was, in a way, the nicest place, I think, for the audience. Because we could really sit up, we could relax, there were seats, it was a garden, it was open to everybody. It was kind of great. We didn't have to worry about getting harassed by police, and that was really nice. And then I wanted the meeting. There's a lot of meetings of the delegates of the commune where they're trying to figure out, like, whether they should be peaceful, whether they should fight back against Versailles, the kind of important political issues. And I wanted that to take place in front of the main public library in New York. If you guys, I don't know how many people know the the great Beaux-Arts building with the lions and everything. And I thought that would be a very grand place. And I also wanted to do it because the commune really believed in free education. And to me, a public library is a great symbol of free education. So I thought it'd be really beautiful, as well as it has a really beautiful plaza and seats and so on. And I thought, we'll never get away with this, because I remember Nira and I looking at the website, you know, the property belongs to the Bryant Park Business Association, and they have all these rules, and like just to take a photograph, you have to get permissions and permits and whatever. I thought, well, we'll try just running in and doing kind of one scene guerrilla style before they stop us. And you know what? Nobody said anything. So we just started to go back. You know, we were not exactly invisible. Red sashes. People had those cardboard heads. Many of the characters, you'll see people in the play wearing these cardboard heads of communards. And that's because they're playing real people, people who actually existed in Paris. So I wanted them to have two heads, their own and their character. So, is it still working?
It is.
Probably a terrible sound. we just went back like week after week. It was really funny. There would be on one side of the public library, there were people casting rods. They were like, it was a fly fishing class. On the other side, there was a Paris commune. But we got along very amicably. No problem. You could choose whatever you wanted to learn about. And there were a couple of other places. Again, I tried to match the location with what was happening in the story. So, for example, when there's a scene outside the Department of Education in the play, we did it outside the Tweed Courthouse, which is the Department of Education in New York.
So I'm wondering about, if you could talk a little bit more about connections between this project and some of your previous work. I'm interested in particular in something that I'm not sure that I've seen you write or talk about that much, which is thinking about, all of your work seems to be about these radical impulses or aspirations or moments that you're sort of recuperating from history that have been suppressed or covered over in the record or in sort of the niceties of bourgeois everyday life. And one of these sort of radical impulses or moments has to do with gender and gender roles. I'm seeing this in a lot of your work. I'm thinking about in the Coney Island Amateur Psychoanalytic Society, the way in which the libido is embodied by this sort of prepubescent female character. Or in the Mutt and Jeff piece, the way in which there's this sort of resistance to industrial efficiency films, and the way in which there's sort of this secretary figure who's defying efficiency. So I was wondering if you had thought about not only a class critique, but the way in which the commune speaks to issues of gender as well.
That's an interesting question. And I hadn't really thought about it going through my work. I mean, there were certain things that I was found inspiring about the commune, for example, women's equality, that women should be paid the same as men, which was a really radical thing back then. It's still, unfortunately, a kind of a radical thing often now. Yeah. I hate to say that. Women fought alongside men in the National Guard. They'd put on men's uniform. Like, we were just looking at her, I'm thinking of her name, Louise Michel, yes, mm-hmm. who put on, you know, national, she fought alongside men in National Guard uniform. So there was that going on. Mm-hmm. So I thought all those things were important, and I kind of took it further in the play. Sometimes I had some of the male characters played by women, like Cecilia played Francois. Mm-hmm. So again, that was kind of to an homage to those women who fought alongside men, and also because today, I think we should take that further. You know, so I don't think, I'm actually thinking a lot now about when I cast something, I should never think about, like, even if the character's a man, it could equally well be played by a woman or a child. You know, I mean, you should never get locked. I am really, this piece freed me up from the idea that there should be kind of a mimetic relationship between character and the person who plays them. Hmm. And This was really important in this project. There were some characters who, some of our performers, Julie was probably the most versatile, who played men, played women, played all kinds of people, played on every side of the commune. So, I mean, we should also talk about that also with the actors,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
But I'm very interested in kind of destroying those kind of mimetic relationships, yeah.
Great. Well, maybe this is a moment when we could bring in the performers.
Is there some kind of microphone we could pass around so performers could...
We can talk loud.
Oh, they can come up.
What? Street theater experience.
Yeah. Oh, why don't you guys come up? Why don't we just bring some of the actors back onto the stage? Bring your... You've got folding chairs? Come on here. Yeah, all of you. All of you are nothing. Like, we need all of you. Join me. Okay, if you are speaking, please, Blaine will have a microphone. Or any chair, just kind of make yourselves at home. Sit down.
The elders of the commune.
Well, I'll... Here, somebody sit here just so... Please, so it's easier. So if you're speaking, guys, take a microphone because they're recording it. That's why you need a microphone.
So we were just talking about the kind of... the way in which Zoe learned from the performance, the long durée of the performance and the seriality of it, right? The way that it happened every weekend over 3 months. So I'm just wondering if any of you could talk a little bit about how you're thinking about the commune or about Occupy Wall Street evolved through the performance across time. Did you find a certain kind of knowledge or spirit emerging in yourself, maybe, that you hadn't thought was there?
I'll talk.
Yeah.
I was going to...
Can you introduce yourself, too?
No, sure. Sorry. Julie Delorier. Is this on?
Yeah.
Okay. I was going to every protest possible and hanging out. And when I found Zoe's piece, it was a way to really experience it artistically and really vent my rage with some real good stuff. I mean, we're talking Brecht here. You know, you don't do better than that. It was great. It was a great synthesis.
I think what was... One thing for me that was interesting about the performance was that how people work together. Like, I was watching, like, people had more experience work with people who were acting for the first time.
Yeah.
How people gradually, like, threw away their scripts and learned their lines. I was, like, so impressed. I didn't feel like I paid people enough that I could ask them to learn their lines off by heart. So I said, initially, just read over your part and get a feel for it. But you can, you know, you're welcome to read if you prefer to read. Hmm. And at first, when you see people in, like, March, everybody's reading. By the end of May, everybody's, like, got it. It was remarkable.
you shivering in March.
I'm Joni Fritz-Ozika, and I followed Occupy Wall Street from the moment that, well, before it was even, before it rolled out onto the street. There was a lot of communication between people in Lower Manhattan and all of the organization that started about a year prior, actually, to when things actually became a public manifestation. And of course, it became worldwide. Was there an Occupy Philadelphia? Of course, of course. Right, I mean, I went to little teeny tiny towns, and Bath, England had one. They had an Occupy group. So there were a lot of things that, you know, I wanted to come to and never could. But when I saw Zoe's notice, I thought, this is something as an actor and an activist that I could really hunker down into, because there were so many elements to me that were appealing. All, you know, especially, you know, as you spoke about it, the corroboration between Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street, and the incredible revolutionary fervor of the communards, you know. And also because I feel like, for a long time at least, I don't know, I always want to make them into total pacifists, since I am, and I know they weren't. But I think that they, at heart, really didn't, you know, they were defending themselves. They were not the, they were not the,
they were pre-conceived.
Yeah, yeah, they weren't, I don't think they were bloodthirsty. They had certain things that they wished to uphold, and they wanted to. And I think that the same thing, in a way, also happened with OWS, in that, you know, as the police and the government, the local government, started to become more aggressive, it became much more of a confrontational situation. So anyway, I was really deeply grateful for, you know, for this project, because I thought, this has really got substance, you know? And also because theater is a collective situation, and in a way, you know, we really formed a communal sort of spirit and worked together in that way, and so we lived it. It was great.
Yeah. Zoe mentioned that when we were shooting, when we were acting on the at the library, we were nervous about what would happen, and so actually we did have a backup plan. I just a little bit off topic here, but. And that is, I've spent my entire life since 1968 cultivating the image of a fake Frenchman. And so what we were going to do was, if the cops would have come to us, because this was guerrilla theater, I was going to say, excuse me, but we are a group of comedians from Paris, and we are just here to shoot very briefly, and we will be here, and we will be gone. Thank you. Excuse us. Merci.
Just like Joni, when Joni actually, my name is Joy Kelly. just like Joni actually sent me the notice for the audition for this, and I was so excited because we had just started to hear about Occupy Wall Street. I live way uptown, so I was nowhere physically near it. And I thought, oh wow, to do theater down there would be so cool. And I was nervous because, you know, they were starting to have problems. The police were starting to be extremely aggressive. And so I looked upon the whole thing as an adventure. Even when we went to the library, because I remember we were told that we might be chased away, but I said, yes, this is an adventure. And I loved, I'm an actress, but I loved working with all different kinds of people. It was so freeing. I love the rawness, and it had, it really, just the way the show was done, just the way the theater, the play was done, really felt like true Brecht to me. Hmm. I mean, you've seen Brecht, but this was really Brecht, because it made you step back and think about what was going on, especially the way we were doing it in little episodes, and the fact that the props were all cardboard and painted, but they looked great on the screen. But it gave that real Brechtian feeling. So yeah, this was just a wonderful experience for me.
Yeah.
Right. I also, by the way, came to this through Joni, who apparently, I'm glad to hear Zoe confirm what I've been telling people, because when I first joined, I said to people, you know, my friend Joni sent me this information about a street theater piece, and apparently the director asked if she knew more actors for this, and I would like to say that, you know, she recommended me as good for this role because of my brilliant talent, but I'm pretty sure it's because of my loud voice. So, I came to this, you know, to start in, let's say, the mid-90s. I was doing a public access TV show called The Anarchist Propaganda and Variety Hour, and I went to tape a 15-minute street theater performance by the Living Theater and basically never left. Met Joni in the Living Theater. I'm now the dramaturge. And so she contacted me last spring, and I got in touch with Zoe and said, well, I can come and do this, you know, play roles for you, but on the weekends I usually have my then 8-year-old, now 9-year-old daughter, who's in the next room there, and she's actually an experienced actress for several years with the Living Theater. Judith Molina writes parts for her, so if you want to stick her in a costume and she can stand there, and it turned out that there's a role of child in the play, which, curiously enough, was the role she had played in her last two plays at the Living Theater. I think it's typecasting, I'm afraid. So anyway, that's how we got involved. Thank you, Joni. And it's exactly, you know, there's a line in a book of theater anecdotes. Tony Randall quotes, I forget which old acting teacher, saying, if there's anything that can keep you from making a career as an actor, let it. Right? Those of us, you know, in any kind of the arts, people know that they do it because they have to, and they, you know, given, you know, that you can stay alive and still do this, you have to find the way to do it. Actually, I'm not that way about acting. I'm that way about acting for Judith Molina and the Living Theater and the kind of stuff that goes on there. I came there from the other side as the anarchist pacifist, and I came into this, and I said, wow, this is it. I was telling Judith all excitedly, you know, there's other stuff going on too, which is all about exactly, you know, changing the future based on, you know, the fact that people for thousands of years have had to look thousands of years ahead, the people of real vision from, you know, Moses and Socrates and Voltaire and Emma Goldman and Freud. You know, it's all one big long struggle about how do we get along. And by the way, our last play that I was, when I got involved with this, working with Judith, researching that she was writing, and which we just last night finished the run of, is called Here We Are. And it's about trying to represent everybody's views through the history of human decision making. And one of the main scenes is the Paris Commune with Louise Michel at the center of it. So after we finished this, the Days of the Commune, I got Mitch to come over and spend an afternoon talking to Judith, who told me afterwards that that was very helpful. So, you know, it's all part of one big thing going into the future. So
maybe we should.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of came at this from a slightly different angle. I'm Cecilia, and like when I heard about this, I was like not very long out of college and was kind of like, you know, kind of like in the corner. But I had a babysitting job and I had an internship at the Wooster Group, and so I kind of like clung to those things. And so in my process of clinging to my internship at the Wooster Group, one of the actresses who I really respect at the Wooster Group, Kate Volk came up to me and was like, Oh, Cecilia, you know, my friend Zoe's doing this thing. You should go. I think you'd like it. And I was like, oh, okay. I'm just gonna do whatever you say. So I kind of entered this not in a space of, you know, this is the revolution and this is our time and let's claim what we have. I kind of came into this in a place of I don't know what the hell to do next. And being with these amazing people, and also not only I don't know what the hell to do next, but also with like, what you know, with like the like a 21-year-old cynicism chip on the shoulder, being like, oh yeah, revolution is dead, guys. Just like, oh yeah, like all my friends who are revolutionaries, or so they claim, basically just play bad guitar. And like, if there's a revolution, it better be good guitar. So I kind of came into this group of people, and despite being kind of a pill, I think they completely embraced me, and I got the opportunity to really open up in a way that I don't think that I would have otherwise, you know, kind of as we all were together and the weather grew warmer and our fingers thawed together, I was, you know, able to like be more of who I am, and thank you guys. Yeah, that's good.
Great. So I think we should now open it up for questions from the audience for Zoe or the performers.
And I enjoyed the lecture by the gentleman who preceded this, and I don't know his name, but Mitch, whatever. I think it was excellent. And I think this is phenomenal. And all the stuff on the wall was amazing, good. This, the pictures and the drawings and everything, phenomenal. But I have to say that I'm taking a course in education taught by a radical Marxist. And I have to say that the basic emphasis of the course is to, we're reading a book called Class Dismissed, in which the sins of the time nowadays are economics and not education. And that we're in an era that everybody is paying all this money to go to college only to graduate and not be able to get a job and owe $100,000 is a sin by all these universities. And I have to say that Ms. Beloff and Aaron, who's a wonderful guy in a fabulous place here, may be part of the buffer that's called the buffer by the capitalist against the common folk when they can't get a job. And the PhDs in this room may be serving coffee at Starbucks when they graduate, taking the jobs away from the poor in the long run. So my question is, you want revolution, I think you gotta do something more than this, as much as I love it, because I love theater. I think it's fabulous, but I have to say, when you look at the unions protest and they put the big rat outside, and I'm not pro-union, especially in the city, you see the puffed up rat going up, load up rat. Have you ever seen that rat in front of places?
Yeah. I think by non-union labor, by the way.
Is it really?
Yes, that was in Harper's Index.
Is that right? Okay. Well, I have to say a lot more than this play has to be done, as much as I love this play and this performance here. And I don't know what the next step is, but you got the collective brains up here have to come up with some better solution than just educating people so they can't get jobs.
Anyway. Would you like to speak to that?
Absolutely. I mean, we have to do more than this play, and that means that we have to change people's consciousness and make people not cynical about the impossibility of it, not basically brainwashed by the everything from the time they're a small child and they're taught that really, you know, insane contradictions are honorable values, that you should oppose the war but support the troops in a way that you wouldn't oppose the mafia's gang war but support the gangsters, except that you support people who are trapped in a role of violence in getting out of this criminal violence, whether it's a gangster or a member of the U.S. military. The point is we have to change some really deep-rooted attitudes, and theater is one way to do that, to get people to really get people to think, question some, what we're trying, I hope what's happening here is that people are starting to question some of their deepest assumptions, and then we can make a revolution, you know, not until we've broken people out of their conditioning.
Yeah, I wanted to speak to that a little too, because having worked with Living Theater for about 25 years, and one of the things that really brought home to me, because I'm a person who can often feel as you do, you know, what is a play going to do, you know, or what is singing, you know, going to do. But these are the daily actions that we have together, where we cook a meal together, or we sit in a room like this, perfect strangers, and we discuss what revolution is and what it might look like, you know, what if another kind of future might look like. And the thing about the arts is that the arts are like a beacon, and they open up your vision so that, you know, I mean, it makes us think a little bit beyond the mundane, the quotidian activities of every day. And so we can begin in a way to see how great we really are and how much we could be capable of. And that is what's wrong with the educational system. The education system is the inculcation system. It is no education. I'm sure you know that, you know. And it's just bullshit because it's preparing people to be work-a-day cogs, you know. So if you get your PhD or your BA or your MA in being a cog, it's all the same. We're not moving along. We're not evolving. You can learn much more, you know, in an afternoon in a gallery like this, really, than sitting in a seminar or a hall, you know. So that's why the arts are so important. It's not everything. We all have to do what we know how to do in order to bring about a revolution.
When the revolutionary time comes, then we're going to be, obviously we and many of the other people out there are going to be revolutionary. I just want to say one more thing to quote Judith Malina again, saying that she said, it's great to be a revolutionary in revolutionary times. We had enormous fun in 1968 in the Living Theater, but what's really even more important is to be revolutionary in pre-revolutionary times, so that you've got something to go on, and you've given people something to go on, and you've gotten all the little seeds out there, and it's not just any one group, obviously, but all kinds of people all across the world being pre-revolutionary, or rather being revolutionary in pre-revolutionary times.
I think we should be kind of wrapping this up, but I just want to say one thing that I learned from the play. And I feel like for me it was a learning experience. And I think learning is even more important than teaching. It's like Brecht wrote, learning plays, not teaching plays. Mm-hmm. And one thing, as I think Mitch said on the steps of the Tweed Courthouse, one of the lines in the play is, don't expect any more from the commune than you expect of yourself. And I keep saying that to myself. Mm-hmm. Don't expect any more from the commune than you expect of yourself. You know, people keep saying, well, what did Occupy, you know, achieve? And I'm like, don't expect any more of Occupy than you expect of yourself. So I like to remind myself about that.
That's great. Yeah.
But if you don't, you know, you can't have a revolution if you can't dance. So that's most important as well. So with that, I think we're going to sing one more song, and then we can all talk to each other on a more one-on-one level.